At lunch on Wednesday, the 12th of November, 69, this is a new reel, Channel One Right, and the continuation of the visit with Lois Dixon at lunch here in the big kitchen on Wednesday, the 12th of November, 69. Now, on this side, she reports on the Bock Tower, but it's way up around 50. There's a good deal of scattered talk before we get to the Bock Tower. Now, there are two things that Florence told me she doesn't get into here. One, the reason for going down there, it wasn't civic, as she said. That was after the end of all her old friends of the 20s, the Hamiltons. And then another thing she doesn't quite get into, she doesn't handle it this way, what she remembers about her travels and experiences are the people she met. And here they don't quite come in. But she does work out this inspirational attitude connected with Edward Bock and that book that we used to hear about so much and never really took seriously, The Americanization of Edward Bock. And she said if she found anyone who didn't have it, she'd give him a copy. So she has imbibed that spirit, this inspirational spirit. He had never done anything for America, so he was going to try to leave it a little better than he found it.
Morning. And sometimes I hear him. I'm not up circulating, but I'm lying on my bed, awake, and I turn on this little transistor to get the, and sometimes I turn it on at 5:30 and they're playing the Star Spangled Banner, but I don't bother to get up on my feet. But then again, if I turn on at 6 o'clock, I get the news, and then Mr. Keyes follows with a little 5-minute devotion. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't have a very pleasant voice, but he has a nice little devotion. I hate to cut him off. I've heard the news and the weather, and I read to him, but I hate to cut off Mr. Keyes. So I just hear his devotion, too. So we've gotten real chummy, Mr. Keyes and I, in that way. And they say, the announcer says, now, by remote control, live, and from the Eastside Baptist Church, we'll bring you Mr. Keyes' devotion.
Yeah. Live.
That's what it says. And I can just imagine him being up there at 6 o'clock in the morning doing that.
But 5 minutes.
Uh-huh. But it's not so. Because I heard it yesterday morning, he's not there. He's not in town. But they still said that same thing. And I tell you where he is, what made me think of it, talking about these things. He has a daughter. His name is Teresa, and she's a nurse. She's on the staff currently at the Alaska General Hospital. She has been an Army nurse, and she had been in service in Heidelberg. And she attended a little Baptist church out from Heidelberg, the paper said. Oh, I know what I read in the paper. And there she met a young man in service from Portland, Oregon. And so they were attracted to each other, and they saw each other while they were there. Then he went his way. He went on to Vietnam in time. She came home. But in the meantime, they've kept up their correspondence, they said. They've kept up their courtship by correspondence and by tape. So now he's safely back. He was safely back from Vietnam in his home in Portland, Oregon. And he and his parents were en route to Gainesville for the wedding. And as they were going through a small town in California, a truck ran into them and killed all three of them.
Oh, Lord, isn't that awful?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that awful?
And so now, Mr. and Mrs. Keyes with Teresa have gone to Portland to the funeral. That's the reason why I know he wasn't there the other morning when I heard him, because he was en route to Portland. I spread that in the paper. But wasn't that a terrible blow?
Oh, yeah.
You know, numbers and the things of their own.
Yeah, and they have to have, they have that elaborate equipment, and they build it all themselves.
Radio
ham. Are you ham?
No, I saw that
from Vietnam. Really, one time, because she had to deliver a calf. She came late. I told him, I said, now I've heard everything. I've had them late because they had to go to the dentist because they had to do this baton twirling, you know, for their practice at the high school. But I said, now I've heard everything. Let go, had to liver cast.
Lois, what were you particularly interested in? I've never been to the Bach Tower. What in general were you going to tell us about that?
Mm-hmm. You've never been to Bach Tower?
No. I don't even know what it is. That's all I know. I never go to National Monument.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you know about the Bach Tower? But it was built by Edward Bach. Edward Bach is editor of the Les Hommes Journal.
Yeah.
And also something about the Philadelphia Ledger. I think he was editor of the Philadelphia Ledger. Anyway, he lived in Philadelphia.
How far back? 20?
Huh?
When the building was 20.
Mm-hmm. It was dedicated on February the 1st, 1929. And given to the American people, President Truman, Calvin Coolidge was down there and received it, accepted it as a gift. Well, it's built on Sand Mountain, which is in the Mountain Lake area, just on the outskirts of Lake Wales. And Sand Mountain is supposed to be the highest point in Florida.
Oh.
And at that time, in the 20s, a mountain lake, it was a golf course and a country club, and with private estates. And it was said at that time that 70% of the richest families in the country had winter homes in Mountain Lake.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be true now, but it was true at that time. And Bach had a home there, and 70% of the people, I know some of them by name, but anyway, and back in his office one day in Philadelphia, I heard this story from the men who built the tower. I went down there in New Year's of 1928 and 29. They were going to have their first concert on New Year's Eve. And I've been reading about it in the paper, and I thought, I want to go down there. I want to find out firsthand about the carillon. And at that time, we had an active PTA in McIntosh, and I did. They met every month. And we had an active civic league that met till, I take it back, we didn't have civic league at that time. That one organized for 30, about 31 out of 32. But anyway, it seemed like I was frequently asked to prepare papers on musical subjects. And I thought, well, I want to get first-hand information about this large, fine carillon, best one in this country. And so I went down there. I wrote down first to find out where I should stay. Went down on the train. And at that time, they said that the only hotel at that time that had open dining room, I didn't want to have to be going out for a meal, was this Hotel Wales, I believe. Now, the Dixie Wales built was a big kind of skyscraper, kind of like this one hotel is up in Gainesville, you know. But they had one of those down there. But their dining room didn't open until in mid-January. Sorry. So I stayed at that place, and I wrote and told them I was a music teacher, and I want to have a room reservation. I want to come down for the New Year's Eve concert, that I was especially interested in the carillon, and I wanted to find out firsthand information about it. So I went down, and that happened to be the place where all the people who had anything to do with the Bach Tower were staying. And it was kind of like the White House up here in Gainesville, so kind of the porches, people sitting around.
Yeah.
And so they just treated me so nice. So they said, well, now we'll introduce you to these people, and they'll be glad to answer any question, tell you, they'll probably take you out there. So they did. Every time they went out, I stayed there for several days, and every time they went out to the tower, it was still being constructed, it wasn't finished. This was January. It was not finished and dedicated until the first day of February. So Mr. Maderi was the architect, Mr. Burrell was the contractor. And I was with Burrell more than I was Maderi. He and his wife, the wives were all down there too. So they were so enthusiastic about it, and it was such an unusual atmosphere about the whole construction. So I said to Mr. Burrell one day, I said, what was your first reaction when you were asked to build this thing? And I seemed like I felt there was something back of it that would be interesting. He said, well, I'll just tell you. He said, I was in my office one day, and Maderi came in. We worked together a good deal. Maderi's the architect. Maderi phoned me and said, I'm on to see you. I have something to talk to you about. So he went in. He said, I'm just from Edward Bach's office. And he said, he wants us to build a bell tower. And he said, my reaction was, and this is what I said. He said, I said, hell, a bell tower? Who wants to build a bell tower? Well, he said, you don't understand. He said, this is different. I'm going to tell you about it. Mr. Bach just told me I'm going to tell you about it. He said, this is going to be a very unusual, very outstanding piece of architecture. He wants to build this thing and landscape this mountain and give it to the United States. And this is the story he told me. He said, I came over here as an immigrant boy. And he said, the United States has been good to me. And he said, I want to do something for the state. And he said, it had just occurred to me that I had forgotten a message that my grandparents sent out to all their children and grandchildren from a little island in the North Sea. This message was, make you the world a bit more beautiful and better for having lived in it. And he said, I haven't done a thing about it. And then he told about his grandparents who went as young couple. And do you know this story? Are you sure?
Lois, let me tell you, it's no, but it's come, it will.
Well, the family was from Holland, and this young couple was sent, his grandparents were sent by the Dutch government to do some kind of work in an island in the North Sea. And when they got there, it was the coldest, the barrenest, the most desolate looking place that this young couple had ever seen. And the grandmother said, why, we can't. We must do something about it. This is terrible. People just can't live like this. He said, we must plant some trees. We must plant, we must get something started. So they talked to the natives around about there. It was populated. And they said, well, nothing grows here. We've tried everything. And she said, well, we'll try something else. Something must grow here. So she said, we're going to plant 100 trees this year. If they all die, they should be planting 100 more. We keep on, we find something. So they planted the 100 trees. Some died, some lived. And that encouraged them. The next year, they planted another 100 of some kind. And they began to live. Then they began to plant grasses, and they began to plant shrubbery and flowering plants. And she said, one morning they woke, and those natives heard for the first time songs of birds. Said, before that time, around the island twice a year, there'd be a fringe of dead bodies of dead birds. In flight from the north to the south, they couldn't make it from one island to the next. And there were no trees to shelter. And some could make it and some couldn't. But there'd be, as she spoke, they said, always the island was fringed twice a year with the bodies of dead birds. But they found the trees. And they lodged there. And the natives heard for the first time the songs of birds.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And then he said, it went on till then they began to landscape. And world travelers began to hear about it, this island in the North Sea. And so they'd go out of their way to go around and see the transformation that had taken place up there. And they spent their life doing that. Meantime, their children went back to Holland, or went back somewhere. They began to have grandchildren all over. But this couple stayed there. And that was their life. and then long to the close of their life, they began to write letters to their children and their grandchildren. Said, let us give you this message. Wherever you are, make you the world a bit more beautiful and better for having lived in it. Mm. And Bob said, I haven't done that. But he says, I'm going to make that sand mound the most beautiful place in this country. I want to top it with a tower, bell tower. I want to put in it the finest bell that's ever been cast. Then I want to give it to the United States. And he said, whatever you need, there'll be money to take care of it. Spare nothing. You find your architect, you find your workman, you find your craftsman. If you have to go across the borders to find it, that's what. But he said, I want this to be distinctly American. And they said at the time it was dedicated that there were only three distinctive pieces of American architecture. Now, that's probably different now. That's been pretty 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But at that time, there were only three. And one of them was this Bell Tower. The other was the Kansas City Liberty Memorial. And the third one was the state capitol in Lincoln, Nebraska. So I want this to be a piece of distinctive American architecture. No country in the world has put together as more brick and mortar than we have. But everything we've built has shown the effect and the influence of European countries and other countries. I want this to be purely American. And it's made out of coquina rock, native to this state. And it's trimmed with pink Georgia marble. So Midair was just on fire. He said, I call it was just like a plane. And I got it that Mr. Bach passed to me. And Rail says, I caught it. And he said, we began to employ people and tell them about it. And everybody, he said, the lowest ones who did the digging, the foundation. Everybody seemed to catch the vision that they were doing something special. And he said, never has been such a piece of work that we've had anything to do with that it has gone off the way this has. Everybody felt they were doing something special.
That's nice. Now, how do I know Edward Bach?
Book. If you know of any young American boy who hadn't read it, I'd like to give him a copy of it. It's called The Americanization of Edward Bach.
The Americanization. All I could think of was The Confessions. The Americanization of Edward Bach.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's a beautifully written thing.
Yes.
So those people, and they were so nice of me, they took me out there every time they go. We went inside, not many people have been inside, been all over. We on New Year's Day, we were up over the bell. They said they were still doing some work on those pelicans that are at the top of the tower. And they said, we want to see that. And the work was not at work today, New Year's Day. So we were up there, and while we were up there, we looked down, and they said, oh, here comes Mr. Breeze, Anton Breeze. He was a caroloneur. He rode around in a foot roaster with the top down. He's a very unique figure in that area. So they said, oh, here comes Mr. Breeze. Said, I hope you'll play. We'd like to hear the effect of the bells while we're above. We're higher than the bells. So sure enough, he came in. He can't even go to the elevator that far to the console room. And he began playing. And we felt that such a wonderful experience. And then they said, now let's go down. We'd like to see him play, if you allow us. So we went in there, and they knew him, of course, and they introduced me and some others in the party. And they said, we'd love to see you play. Play a number while we observe. And said, we have a music teacher, and she's come down here especially to find out what she can about this carillon and this tower, and anything you can say that would be of interest to her, while we appreciate it. So he played, of all things, he played Beethoven's Minuet in G.
Yeah.
That trio goes so fast, you know. Well, and he plays it, the keyboard, just wooden pegs that come out like this. And he plays it this far of the hand. And so we stood there, just thrilled to death about seeing him play. And when he got through, while we clapped our hands, he got up from the stool and bowed. Then he looked at me and said, "You play. You play." Oh, I said, I wouldn't know where to begin. Mr. Burrell came and stood by behind me. He said, "Sit down and do nothing but ring a bell. This is a chance in a lifetime." So I was, then when I looked at it, I could see that these lower hammers that came out here were all even. Then up above, they were in groups of twos and threes, like the black keys on film.
Yeah.
So then I knew my way around a little bit,
yeah,
when I discovered that. So, you know, everybody standing around, the moment was so tense, I didn't know what in the world to do, hardly. But I just played an F. I heard that bell. And I played it again. Then I played the G. I came down and played the E. And then the F and the G. And I played My Country, Tis the Leaf. I didn't play but one bell at a time. They called me the one finger bell ringer. But I did play that. And it was in the paper, the Lake Wales paper the next day, said people heard somebody playing the one finger, My Country, Tis the Leaf. And discovered it was this visitor from Macintosh.
Yes.
I had that newspaper clipping down home.
Oh,
yes. And then they said to me, the Burrells and the Madaris and the Wakeman was the sculptor, and Mr. Yellen did the wrought iron work. They said, "You come back here for the dedication." They're going to be dedicated the first day of February, and there were going to be 1,500 reserved seats. And the first 500 were given to Mr. Bach's neighbors, the residents of Mount Lake. And the second group of 500 seats were given to the Madeiras and the Burrells and everybody who had anything to do with working on that, for them to give to their family or their friends. 500 seats, 500 tickets. And then the third section was given the Chamber of Commerce in Lake Wales. Now, the whole lot, more than 1,500 people there, their places all over the mountain, sanctuary, people were standing. But there were 1,500 reserved seats right in front of the speaker. And so they said, "We have 500 tickets, so I suppose we'll give you them." So they didn't have them then, but they mailed them. They mailed it to me. And I went back.
Oh, really?
On February the 1st.
That,
and first time I was ever that close to a president. I never saw as much red tape and servicemen in my life. And in those days, it must be worse now, but it's bad enough then.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Coolidge. Yeah, that was a lovely experience. I just on and on.
Now, everybody knew about that.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
It was written up in all the papers,
mm-hmm,
and magazines.
Mm-hmm. And somebody was there that day, the day of the dedication, taking some very wonderful pictures, had very impressive cameras. So we said, the word got around that he was taking it for some magazine. So we said, "Well, we didn't get a hold of that man. Let's ask him about magazine he's representing, because we'd like to buy that magazine. He's getting such wonderful shots." So somebody got in touch with him. And he said, "Well, I'm taking these pictures for architecture." And said, "The magazine isn't sold on the newsstand." But he said, "If you give me a list of interested friends, I'll send a copy." So my name was given to, they gave it my name too, so I have a copy of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It came out in April 1929, but he was taking these pictures on February the 1st. But the article and the pictures came out in April. And when you start in start walking up the mountain, the Sand Mountain, we call it. It's beautiful landscape. And the Mr. Armstead was the landscape architect. And on either side, on two sides of the mountain, are very huge water tanks. So they'll never suffer from drought. They're always able to water. And it's a bird sanctuary. They have some nightingales. They're protected. They're in a cage, but in such a large cage that they hardly realize that they are. But they're fixed so they can't fly away. Get away. And of course, beautiful flowers and walkways and everything. And when you enter, as the first little sign that you see would be, I come here to find myself. It is so easy to get lost in the world. John Burroughs. Then farther up, they have carved, what is it, the kiss of the sun for pardon? The smile of a child for mercy, but you knew God's heart in the garden than any place else on earth. Then there's a little a little place that is has flagstones and a seed and a fountain and I forgot what to call it. It has a special name, but I can't call that now. But the and there's a marker there. The it's in one of the choice places on the mountainside, and that was prepared by his friends, the Mountain Lake, and they have a marker saying to our friend and neighbor. It's about by his friends and neighbors in Mountain Lake. And then inside the tower, they call attention to a very beautiful Steinway tunnel that Joseph Hoffman had given. Mr. Bach played some himself. And Joseph Hoffman had given Mr. Bach this tunnel with a brass mark on it, of course.
Well, that makes me feel nostalgic.
Does it?
Yeah. I've sort of lost interest in the Washington Market now.
Oh, have you? Uh-huh. Well, now, listen, I must run along. Are you sure you're through putting out the fertilizer?
We got a lot of other things.
You've got a lot of other things. You've got a lot of other things to do. Well, I'll
3:15 to 20, Channel 1 right, on this new reel and the end of the visit with Miss Lois at lunch up here in the big kitchen on Wednesday, the 12th of November, 69, around 3:20, Channel 1 right on the new reel and the end of the visit with Miss Lois on the Bach Tower and Ms. Peterson, those two subjects. On at lunch on Wednesday, the 12th of November, 69, Channel 1 right, around 3:20.
Something occurred to me that wasn't particularly the right attitude. It also occurred to me that I was rather horribly self-centered. See, I had a friend at center who knew everybody. And she would come into the room and she'd start talking about somebody and I'd say, I don't know who you're talking about. Well, she's right here on campus. We've only got 500 people here. You should know who I'm talking about. Say, I don't know her. Well, she's in one of your classes. That doesn't make any difference. She hadn't talked to me. I don't know her. Well, you ought to know her. There's no excuse for you not to know her. Oh, she would chide me. And I'd get mad. I'd just fear.
Say, oh, no. She would chide you.
Well, chide's not the word, because she would, yeah, she'd tell me, I ought to be interested in these things. I ought to know people. I ought to want to know what's going on. And I wasn't interested in politics. And she was an active young Republican and went around and carrying young Republicans around since she was one of the few people with a car. She'd say, why don't you go join a club here and there? And I'd say I wasn't interested.
You mean just flat statement about that?
Yeah. She things like these political groups, they don't interest me in the least. They still don't interest me. And she would say, well, you ought to be interested, you know, you ought to take an interest. It's something, somebody, we get in long arguments about it, and they were arguments. She was my best friend, but we argued more than anything else. I think we would just stay together all the time so that we could yell at each other.
You mean it got animated?
Animated is not the word. It got to blows.
Now, Barbara.
Well, tell me about sometime like that.
Oh, go. Other than that, childish, it wasn't worth it on both our parts.
Well, for instance.
She was taking German, which I was intensely interested in. See, I wasn't interested in people, but I was interested in German.
And she was interested in people, but not in German?
Well, she was taking German, and she pretended she would talk about how well she was doing in it, and she would sort of run me down and talk about how much more difficult her professor was. And she would look at my papers and see the mistakes I'd made and say, I would make an A, and she'd say, well, you would have made an F in Miss Johnson's class. And this is one reason we used to fight a lot. So I started going over to Dr. Yeager's for conversation. There were about four of us who were supposed to do it, and I was the only one who ever went. And she said that she was interested, and Dr. Yeager had said that someone from Mrs. Janssen's classes could come if they wished. And one afternoon when I was very tired, and I happened to know that probably, I think it was the first time, I knew that there was nobody else going. I had been over there several times, but this was the first time I was sure that nobody else was going to be there besides me and Dr. Yeager. And she had promised she would come, and she came in, and she was also tired, and said she wasn't going to go. And I asked her why not. She'd said that she was going to do this. She had promised me she would go. And she just said that she wouldn't be held to such promises or something like that. And it was so stupid. But I was furious because this was just one more thing on top of a whole series of things that, to get mad at her about. And it ended with her saying something about I shouldn't be such a child and me slamming the door and jumping out of the room. After first accusing her of being a promise breaker. And also of being not interested in German.
Hey, that sounds like a right healthy little roommate.
I'm
healthy.
I'm making more notes than him.
Yeah.
And I was, it was funny, we I don't make friends. I when I'm with people for a long time, I either sort of work into a friendly relationship, or I'm instantly friends with somebody, and those are the people that are close to me. And if I sort of, I don't know what it is, but just every once in a while I'll meet someone and we think Not a light, but close enough light so that there's that. And I don't necessarily like them.
Oh.
Now, Marilyn, I didn't like then, and I still don't like. And yet, if we were ever together, we would stay together. Even though we fight like cats and dogs. That's why I can understand people falling in love and hating each other at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Marilyn would do things to humiliate me. It was her way. She did it to everybody. At the same time, she could be very kind and very generous, but it was on her own terms. And this thing about the Germans, you know, just going over my papers and talking about how I would have gotten an F in her class. And she would talk about her mother until finally I decided all her ideas were her mother's. And as if her mother were the only mother in the world that ever brought up a daughter right. Or who had ever had the experiences her mother had had. And she read, I couldn't, she read extensively and over all areas. This is something I knew I didn't do. She read far more than I did. And she could talk about, I mean, she knew what she'd read. And she could remember it. And I'm the same way with some books. Not books that I've gotten into, but some books, the way I am about people. And about music. I'll remember the quality and forget the composer or the title and everything else, and just remember the impression.
Mm-hmm.
And she would chide me about that.
Well, now, what was it about her mother that was she thought was so unusual?
Oh, her mother was, according to her. Her mother was the only woman in Paducah, Kentucky who had taste. Her mother was the only woman in Paducah, Kentucky who had any sort of culture. And Paducah, Kentucky was just a hole filled with her relatives. Her father's relatives. Not only that, but her mother had educated her father to everything he knew about culture, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh.
I felt sorry for the poor man. He took it. She wasn't quite what Marilyn made out. Fortunately, I could never have stood the few visits I made down there. Her mother was much more liberal than Marilyn was. But,
Well, what did she say about her mother?
Well, you see, her mother was from, well, she was from Illinois, but she had lived in New York. And she had been the first of her family to have a college education. And she had worked her way through college, I think. But more than this, she had gone on. I forget all the qualifications she was supposed to have. But Marilyn said that she had a PhD. She taught at Well, she was often invited to teach and give lectures at Paducah Junior College there. And according to Marilyn, she should have been able to get a position at a college or university, but she didn't want it. She was being housewife, you think. But that she knew more than any of the professors at Paducah, well, junior college, which she probably did. I wouldn't deny that, not knowing any of the professors at Paducah. BJC, but...
Well, she's just proud of her mama, wasn't she?
She is proud of her, but it went so far.
And she talks about it.
Constantly.
And she was going to be a good student like her mama.
She I don't know what her attitude was. She wanted to be she's studying archaeology.
That's enough.
Yeah, well.
Barbara? What you can do? She knew everybody. You didn't. You could just see them through her eyes. And save yourself the trouble of...
That's what I did, but she couldn't understand that. Now, you see, remember the little girl I was talking about? Who dieted so much?
Yeah.
Until she was half star. Every bit of information I got about her, I got from Marilyn.
Now I've forgotten the girl. What was that?
Well, she was a little girl who came on campus. My sophomore year.
Yeah.
She was a freshman, and I'd happened to see her a few times and thought, poor little thing.
Yeah.
And Marilyn came in and was talking about somebody, and I said, I don't know her. And she said, oh, you know her. She's that little thin little bits of sticks that wanders around the campus. And I say, oh, she's in my art class. And her mother came to visit, and her mother looks just like her. I say, oh, really? And then she talked about it. She'd make Marilyn nervous in art class because she said, you know, that she thinks that she is too fat. I said, I thought she was suffering from some terrible disease. What do you mean? And she says, no, she diets to keep that way. I've watched her. And this is how I would never do. I've watched her at lunch and suppers and so on. And all she ever gets is a salad. And she's on a diet. She thinks she's too fat. And it makes me nervous in art class because I know Marilyn's a huge girl. She's 5'11" and big, strong build and strong, too.
Well, you can't feud with Amazon.
I know. I suffered for it. She kept me on the floor. I couldn't move.
Hey, she would.
That was when she was playing. I'd be working away and she'd attack, and there was nothing I could do about it. But she said that when she was in art, she'd look over there at this little tiny girl with this just bird-like bill and think, if she thinks she's too fat, what on earth does she think of me? She must think the rest of us are giants or something, you know. And her mother was just like her. And I didn't even know she couldn't have not even had a mother as far as I was concerned.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about her, you ought to say, according to Marilyn.
I tell you, I haven't finished reading in time.
Well.
But I can see it in the description of the summer. But, and I can see as she describes the children up to a point. I'm sure I'm missing a good deal, but.
No. That's Barbara's talk on her roommate. I forget just which day it is. Up to 560, Channel 1 right, 560, Channel 1 right, 560. This is Friday morning at 9 o'clock, the 14th of November, 69. Friday morning at 9 o'clock, the 14th of November, 69. Flora just called to tell Faye that Lewis's jewelry store in Gainesville is selling out at half price and be good to go by and look up over things for Christmas. And she took the conversation on into what's Lewis. This is Flora on Lewis.
I said Lewis jewelry store is going out of business.
Oh.
And everything in there is half price. So I went in yesterday. I didn't know it was going out of business.
Yeah.
I didn't get anything large, but, you know, I picked up some small things. But, I mean, everything in there.
Why, Flora?
And people going in just buying by the whole thing, you know. Well,
yeah.
If they have something to do or give, you know, that's just a savings in a lifetime.
Where is that?
That's right near the Primrose Grill.
Yeah,
you know, it's
on the corner there.
It's right across from, let's see. Yeah, it's right down the corner of the Primrose Grill.
Yeah.
And there are two parking things right in the back of the store. If you go around by Shaw and Keita,
yeah,
and come down that one-way street, and
yeah,
then come down between that and the bank, you see, you can. They have a sign up there for use while parking at Lewis Jewelry Store.
Yeah.
It's right down, right back of the store, and then you have to walk around to University Avenue to the store, which isn't, but just a...
Flora, what sort of things do they have other than just the regular jewelry things?
Well, they have baby things, all types of jewelry, and you know, knives and forks and spoon sets, and they have clocks, and they have all... watches, and they have necklaces. Until Mark, I almost bought myself a necklace.
Oh, really?
I didn't look at the earrings.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's all in the jewelry line, you know.
Yeah.
But still, if something's priced $50 and you want it,
yeah,
for $25, it's just a savings.
Well, do they have any of this, sort of interest in cookery, you know?
No.
Lots of times, you know, some of the jewelry stores do those. Red and yellow and
no,
blue.
No, they don't stock things like that. They had some Belgium sugar and creamers that, you know, didn't have a handle on the sugar.
Yeah.
It was crystal and then the silver base. I didn't especially like it. It wasn't attractive, and if you didn't know it came from Belgium, you wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah.
I would like some of the other things perhaps like that, but it was all right, but maybe some of the brides wouldn't like it. Older people might, you know, but most of them have 4 to 7 dozen of those things, you know.
Yeah.
I might have something else interesting to tell you. I've been invited to go to see some things today that belongs to a woman personally, and she has invited Ms. Arnold to come. Ms. Arnold was going to take me, so I'm not at liberty to tell you about that, but if I find that she is selling her things, you know, it's in a home. So
we would be interested if you do find this out. Bob and I were just talking, the other day, wishing that we had some place like that to go.
Yes, I never know things like that unless somebody tells me.
No.
And that's the thing about it. But this woman just, Ms. Arnold invited me to go, and I told her I couldn't go this morning because I was away from home yesterday. Yesterday was a terrible day, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
It didn't storm in Gainesville like it did here this day.
Well, it rained pretty hard around 2 o'clock,
well,
and it got dark.
I was in the grocery store.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I had to get out.
Yeah.
But, they said that thunder and lightning and everything else.
It was just,
we had some thunder and lightning up there, but nothing alarming, I think.
Uh-huh.
But,
Flora, we would just, I want, we had, I don't know, I've been real busy, been in town almost all of every day.
I knew you'd been busy.
And,
but I missed you.
Well, I sure missed you, and we're going to come by. And I miss, when's Purdy coming back?
Thanksgiving, he'll be here for the day. I guess he'll get back. He starts to work Monday.
Oh, I see.
And so we're hoping they'll let him off that Friday.
Yeah.
Because he'll still be in the training program for until he kind of gets back into routine again, you know. But after being gone a year, things do change, you know.
Yeah.
So he'll be in the training program until, several months, I guess, maybe two or three. I don't know how long, according to how fast he progresses.
Yeah.
But he's gotten his apartment all fixed and bought his own furniture. And Charlotte said he showed real good taste. He bought a bedroom too. And so Mark's made him a record holder since he's here. And he wrote us a card yesterday. He said he'd washed dishes in the new dishwasher. So that was the real thing. Not a new one, but one in the apartment.
Yeah.
So he's real thrilled over getting set up and everything. So I'm hoping they can come home. Arma and Charlotte come for dinner. Then we might go up there for Christmas.
You might go there for Christmas.
Mother isn't too well. How about your mother?
She's all right. She's been back to the eye doctor. Of course, it was a little shock to me to find her not as well when I got up there.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just don't expect her to change.
You were up there.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
She was dizzy.
Yeah, well, she's better from that.
Uh-huh. And Francis got over her.
Yeah. Yeah, but
right.
Mother doesn't want to go as many places as she did, and this is understandable.
She didn't go to Sunday Church Sunday, so it's just a good bit of effort to go, and it's hard on Ruth, too.
Yeah.
It's easier for Mother to stay home for both of them.
Yeah.
Because she likes to go and she hates to give up, but that time does come.
Yeah.
Well, you and Barbara get by when you can.
Well, we will. And Lois came up the other day. We enjoyed her. Doesn't she have a pretty tight schedule? Lois.
Uh-huh. Fairly tight.
We have it's sort of hard to get hold of her.
Uh-huh. Well, she, I know she's going up to, she gives organizations to Eleanor Rogers up at Warburg.
Oh, she goes to Warburg.
She's going up there this afternoon.
Uh-huh.
So, she goes, I think on Thursday, but it storms, so yesterday.
Yeah.
I guess you know they clean Alice's lot and have the corners up.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. They put the corners up yesterday because that's just temporary because they'll have to go up and measure some more and be sure the garage doesn't cut out their side of the lake, you know, and things. But they smoothed it off Wednesday morning and we were over there all Monday afternoon and had the bulldozer and the saw going.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jolene didn't pay a bit of attention. Didn't bother her one time.
Is that right?
Well,
I was saying about Lois, I never did, you know, I knew that she taught and worked at the church, but she must do a lot of things with people, for people.
Oh, she does, always has. I don't know what McIntosh does to all the people down there would have done through the years without
Lois. Well, just taking people around?
Well, she takes them around, she gets the mail, she does a lot of sunscreen church work.
Yeah.
She's a very dedicated person. I said there's no one like Lois in this part of the world I know about.
I've heard you say that.
Yes, but she just, and she does it because she wants to. I've always heard people say you can do anything you want to, but that isn't true. Now, if you don't have anybody to get meals for or no one to answer to, and you have she doesn't have an unlimited amount of money or anything like that. She has to teach, and she lives on what she teaches.
Oh, she lives on what she teaches.
Yeah. But she doesn't count what she spends for gasoline. She enjoys her car, and I'm glad she enjoys something.
Oh, yeah. Well, hadn't she, and she sort of is so good to people like Miss Hattie.
Oh, yeah. She and Hattie have been friends for years, but I think if they go to town, Hattie buys the meals and Lois furnishes the car, which is right.
Yeah.
So it's not all one-sided. I mean, people are nice to Lois too, you know.
Yeah.
So, but she does, and she's always planning something. She came by to see the children the other day when she was going to Johanna.
She said she did.
They're so fond of Lois, and of course she's made over Mark, but Jolynn's about to win her heart now.
Oh, so really?
Jolynn isn't as timid as she used to be, you know, and she just smiles for him. Mark calls her D. LD, you know, we call him LD. It's a good time. He can say D.
Uh-huh.
He's talking real plain. I'm teaching him to say Grand Sue to the, and Grand Dick to the arms.
Yes.
Because they'll be right next to him.
Yeah, that would be cute. Well, I just never knew anybody like Lois. You had told. I don't know her, but I just know her through you.
Uh-huh.
And you had told me that she was so well.
She's the most unselfish person, and giving of her time and everything. And as she said, we were talking about the toast of blessings, you know, you and I one time.
Yeah.
But she said that she always tried to think of herself as music missionary.
Yeah.
Because so many of the children in this era wouldn't have ever known anything about music if she hadn't been liberal in her charges.
Oh. So you know, part of that is just a service.
And that's what she said. She said she liked to think herself as a musical missionary.
A musical missionary.
I think that's just wonderful.
Yeah. And
I said I used to take from her. It took an hour, a week. But I said it was more to be with us than
it was. Isn't that interesting?
I think
maybe some people do feel that way. I would feel that way.
I just feel like to just take an hour off that I could really enjoy somebody, because I don't often do that, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I just look forward to that hour with Lois. And she said she never punished the guy that asked anyone. She tried to instill the love of music in people's lives.
Well, now, she not only does the music down at her church, but she teaches Sunday school.
Yeah, I'm teaching.
She feels she has to do that, too?
Uh-huh.
Flora talks for a good long time now about Lois going in late at night by herself with all the trouble in the neighborhood. So I won't keep that. This is around 790, Channel 1 right, around 790, the telephone talk that Faye had with Flora this Friday morning of the second moonshot, Apollo 12, around 9 o'clock, the 14th of November, 69, and a cold wave is on its way. We got an inch rain from it yesterday, but it's still balmy this morning. Now, that's the end of the little telephone talk, the part I would have wanted to keep. Flora called Faye this morning, Friday, the 14th of November, 69, about 9 o'clock. Tell her the drugstore was selling out and things were at half price in town. And she laid on into Lois and other things. But the surprising little information. So this Channel 1 Right, 805. Channel 1 Right, 805. Friday, the 14th of November, 69.
No, it's Missy Molly. It's not Boosie, it's Missy and Molly. I went out there this morning to fix it, you know. Went out with the hammer to set the poles right.
Yeah.
And I got out there, and there were a couple of calves in there. They weren't doing anything. And Missy and Molly were in there. So I was riding Boosie. I rode Boosie in and herded the calves out, and they went right on out. Didn't disturb anything.
I can finish it, but Missy and Molly wouldn't herd out.
Not only would they not herd out, but when they did, come to think of it, it was after I'd fixed everything up. I went out there by myself and fixed everything up. And then I rode Pussy out there to work her.
Yeah.
And those two horses were in there.
Yeah.
When they decided that they would herd out, there was a section open, and the section next to it was closed. So which section did they decide to go out through? The closed one.
Oh.
And it was, the rope was, one of the calves had loosened the rope. and Molly stepped over it and then caught her hind leg on it and proceeded to bend the pole flat so that she could get off. And I worked Boosie out there. I straightened the poles up best I could and worked Boosie out there. And I came back and waited for the Vivian. And when Vivian got here, I took her out there, and who should be in there but Misty and Molly scratching themselves on the pole.
Again?
I think it's jealousy. I think they just they see Pussy and Huey working out there, and they just get jealous.
Yeah.
Tear it down.
Yeah.
Get out of the way.
Huh?
When we chased them out.
When they ran up here?
Mm-hmm. Molly wasn't so bad, except bending the pole that one. She got caught. But Missy has that evil gleam in her eye.
Yeah.
Out there to pound stakes in, she was found one of the corner ones and was scratching herself on it and had bent it all the way over so that it was underneath her stomach. It looked like she had the thing going up through her stomach. If I hadn't seen her do it, I would have been a bit frightened. Yelled at her and she just looked at me. Again and she just looked at me. And she very slowly backed away from the bowl. It's a calf. I know better now.
Barbara, I read some of your letters last night. One of them, you had a half interest in that little car, like you told me. You know, you said that.
Yeah.
Now, you traveled a good bit while you were over there.
Well?
You didn't stay right there on the plantation all the time.
No. No. I got around a little bit here and there. Most of it was on that 6 weeks, though. I mean, not six, 2 weeks. 2 weeks I had.
Well, now once you went up to the place and to the coast and in Wales and stopped by to see Jane.
Yeah, that was on the beginning of my 2 weeks holiday.
Oh, it was.
When I went to the Three Counties show with them.
Oh?
I stopped, spent the night, first night with Jane. And,
Well, now, this wasn't overnight. This was just an hour.
An hour. Oh, that was when we went to Bourke. That's, when three or four of us went to Bourke. Now, that was a beautiful day.
Yeah.
That was in early July, and we'd just gotten that Ford.
Yeah.
And there was a little Flemish boy on holiday at the Telks.
I mean, you're just unconscious of this. You ought to manipulate it.
We had get off and go to the coast. So it just a beautiful day, and we piled into that car at something like 6 o'clock in the morning. Before we had breakfast or anything, we sneaked into the club room and fixed ourselves whatever we were going to eat. We piled into the car and. First of all, we drove to Jane because it was on our way. It was the way we were going. And we stopped there. That's where we had met the pigs.
Yeah.
Those foolish piglets.
Took you a while to get a pig across the road or something.
Oh,
like
yeah. Took us quite a while. We had to get them out from the pen. Through the barnyard and across the road over to their lot where they could be out during the day. And they didn't want to go. And they just scattered, all five of them just scattered all over the barnyard. And the old sow just went on her way, left them. She knew where she was going and they could take care of themselves. And Mrs. Wilde was wandering around picking up pigs from their hind legs and tossing them after their mother, and they'd turn around and run the opposite direction. And if they could find a place where they could squeeze between something, they would do that. And a couple of them got between the gate and the wall and couldn't figure out how to get out.